Thank you for that. Yesterday, about this time of day, I read the account that Ajahn Onalio gave of being with Ajahn Chah when he asked about the seeing water that was moving, and seeing still water and still moving water. And I'm not going to repeat that quote today, but I'm going to read a direct teaching of it from Ajahn Chah himself. And we're going to start with that. And where we're headed here is stillness and movement in regards to time. And where we're going from that tomorrow is to the nature of awareness itself, as seen in stillness and movement. So this is Ajahn Chah speaking. Stillness is tranquility, and flowing is wisdom. We practice meditation to make the mind calm like still water, then it can flow. In the beginning, we learn what still water is like and what flowing water is like. After practicing for a while, we see how these two support each other. This is Ajahn Chah's words, not mine. But both being still and flowing, this is something not easy to contemplate. We can understand that still water doesn't flow. We can understand that flowing water isn't still. But when we practice, we experience both of these together. The mind of a true practitioner is like still water that flows, or flowing water that's still. Whatever takes place in the mind of a Dharma practitioner will have this quality. Only flowing is not correct. Only still is not correct. When we have experience of practice, our minds will be in this condition of flowing water that is still. Straight enough teaching, I think. So, out of this experience of my own, led me to get interested in this and this way. Hope everybody, this is a Buddha sitting on elephants, the royal Buddha, the ennobling of the Buddha. So I'm going to get real close. Hopefully you can nod your head if you can see the face. Okay, good. So this is serenity. This is the serenity. This is the stillness. And what people think of the Buddha in terms of his impact is that this stillness is, this stillness leads to the wisdom. And that's not incorrect, but it's the stillness that leads to the flowing. It's the stillness of the concentrated, calm mind that is in equanimity, not just in calmness, but in terms of the awakening factors. It's also in equanimity, meaning that when something is jarring to it, it is not affected by the jarring, by not perturbed by perturbances I describe in the Dancing with Life book. And so, yes, we're contemplating, we aspire to have our own serenity, our own calm, our own equanimity in relation to experience. To what experience? The flow of experience, the ever-changing experience. But we also, and this is not to be forgotten, the Buddha is sitting here and he is watching the flow of experience. He is having insights. On the night of his awakening, there was all sorts of movement. You know, Mara appears in all of these different ways, the temptations of mind. So he was like this on the outside, but on the inside, he was having to respond and, for the first time ever, conquer these things that were disturbing him. So we're practicing the gradual path in this manner. It's not just the stillness, but the use of the stillness to understand the movement of desire, the movement of greed, the movement of grasping, the movement of aversion, but also the movement that's associated with love, with caring for others, with social justice. It's all movement. We're not just labeling movement as bad, but movement has a certain quality that is called a Nietzsche, that it's changing, it's ever changing. And so in that ever changing flow, there's not stability. That's why this stillness is necessary, so that we're not identified, that our only experience is the up and down, the swirls, the eddies, the roaring, the waterfalls of our ever-changing experience. That's why Ajahn Chah, in my understanding of it, is saying that both are necessary. And that's why I believe this is such an important thing to be studying. Is it like, it kind of opens us at another level, and it's a felt experience. So the felt experience of stillness. And we have that when we go to a concentration retreat. I teach concentration retreat every single year for almost 20 years now. And that's a useful way to get there. But so is just knowing the stillness moment to moment. And it will bring you to concentration, like in this the first sit this morning, I got more concentrated than I was having to stop myself from getting carried in too deeply into concentration. So the stillness will bring you to concentration, and the concentration will bring you to stillness. But by looking at the stillness in this direct way, it helps us in these different ways. This is the Venerable Sumedho, Longpo Sumedho speaking. The Buddha pointed to the instability of conditioned phenomena, to their impermanence. This is not just a philosophy that he was expecting us to go along with. We explore and see the nature of the conditioned realm in just the way we experience it, the physical, the emotional, and the mental, a version of what I was talking about, physical, vital, and emotional. But that which is aware of it, your refuge is in the awakened awareness, rather than trying to find or create a condition that will give us some sense of security. So he's now introduced this idea of awakened awareness. We're not trying to fool ourselves to create a false sense of security by positive thinking. The refuge is in awakening to reality, because the unconditioned is reality. This awareness, this awakeness, is the gate to the unconditioned. When we awaken, that is the unconditioned. The actual awareness is that. The conditions, whatever they are, strong, weak, pleasant, or painful, whatever, they pass. And so this stillness gives us a sense of the anicca. It's also the balance, as I said when we were doing our field reports this morning. It's the balance of having the concentration, the samadhi that's necessary for vipassana. And then the movement is the movement of mind that's necessary, because you have to be mindful to get concentrated. So they are interdependent in that sense. They are. It is truly what we're creating is a condition of stillness and flowing in the mind, stillness and movement. And this is happening all the time anyway, but we don't notice it as such, and we haven't learned how to take advantage of what we already know in a way that we make it practice. We have the felt sense of it in such a way we can summon it forth, that we can balance ourselves. And I've talked numerous times about the the participant observer. The participant is in the flow and seeing dukkha and what is not dukkha, and that there's a choice and making that choice and understanding how it's put together. That's the movement of mind for insight purposes. It's moving, it's examining, it's reflecting. And the serenity allows the stillness, the concentration allows all of this to occur, that we can. It's very hard to have some of these insights. It's unsettling and it's challenging to the ego. And so this concentration makes the hindrances that arise from the ego held at bay. They're held at bay. And therefore we're able to see it the way it is. That's what happens in Vipassana. In our great depth of samadhi, we gain faith from that depth of samadhi, and our mind becomes more able to move to the right degree of concentration in terms of Vipassana, a wise, a skillful degree of balance. What's my order I want here? In the Bhagavad Gita, there's a teaching that T.S. Eliot puts in the Four Quartets as an Anglican Christian, and I am suggesting it here today in terms of Buddhist. So therefore, that's something of a universal teaching candidate, at least, if not true. While time is withdrawn, while we're not in time, like when we're meditating, like when we're doing walking meditation and we're just present and we have more of that sense of the stillness than the movement, even in walking meditation. While time is withdrawn, consider the future and the past with an equal mind. At the moment, which is not of action or inaction. A moment when it's not of action or inaction, that is still flowing. That's water that's still and flowing, or flowing water that's also still, just like Ajahn Chah is saying. Because we can have these moments. This is not like some rare thing for only the special. While time is withdrawn, consider the future and the past with an equal mind. At the moment which is not of action or inaction, you can receive this. This is the teaching. On whatever sphere of being the mind of a person may be intent at the time of death. So I changed that. It says that the time of the mind of a man may be intent, but I could say man, woman, he, they, you know, skipping up a sand person. The mind of a person may be intent at the time of death. That is the one action which shall fructify in the lives of others, the time of death. But now I skip a line in there that's in parentheses. You can receive this on whatever sphere of being the mind of a person may be intent at the time of death. That is the one action, and the time of death is every moment which shall fructify in the lives of others. And do not think of the fruit of action. Fare forward, O voyagers. The time of death is every moment. That's a Nietzsche. That's a Nietzsche. In the flow of time, every moment has a birth, a duration, and an ending, a cessation. We can frame it in terms of it's really fast. We can see those little fast moments of it. We can see it as units. We can see the whole inhale, as I mentioned yesterday, as a birth, a duration and ending. We can see one complete birth by framing it this way. We notice it this way as a beginning and a middle and an end. Our mind is flexible, fluid, in a way that we can see different periods of time, which is very fortunate. And so therefore, in my view, we want to be careful about defining a single unit of time, as that is what is meant by time. That's what's my moment. I feel as though there's, in regards to different ways of practice, we would hold the beginning of a sit, the duration of a sit, and the end of the sit. That can be an appropriate way to frame a time too. So, and again, I know this is a little complicated for some of you at the beginning, but you're going to be swept into this, and this may be the only time anyone will ever mention anything like this to you, because people are drawn to different views, and they report that view, and it's true, but it's not the only truth. There's a different, at least in my experience. Okay, so this is the first thing that. That we live in time. This is the paradox. We live in the flow of time. The analogy is the flowing water. We live in the flow of time. There's no denying that. And why would we want to deny that? And yet, if we only meet it that way, then we're always in a reactive state around our wanting. Logical. Why wouldn't we be that? But that we all know from our experience that there's things more important than other things. So we can you take the pain that I hear, that I can only say is having heard, of a woman giving birth to a child. That choice of that extreme pain is for a reason that is more important. You think of someone enduring something in a war. You think of the people right now in the caring of the hospitals and all these nurses and doctors and what they're exposing themselves, the exhaustion they're going through. They're living for something higher, and they're making that choice really moment by moment in reality, because any moment they could stop, any moment they could not extend. They could still be there, but not extend. So we all live in this the stillness of our deeper values in the flowing moment. Does that make sense to you? So we don't necessarily comprehend that in a manner that is empowering to us and enriching to us, in my view. Going back to the still point from last night, since some people weren't here. At the still point of the turning world, neither flesh nor fleshless, neither from nor towards, at the still point, there the dance is. The dance is in the stillness. But neither arrest nor movement. So it's not like you're stopped, nor are you moving. It's paradoxical. And this is the paradox of time. And awareness and time, we encounter this paradox, whether we're conscious of it or not. But neither arrest nor movement, and do not call it fixity. Boy, is that true. And do not call it fixity where past and future are gathered. Where is past and future gathered? In this very moment. In this very moment, we can understand the past and utilize the past. In this very moment, we can make decisions and actions or words, commitments that affect the future. Because why only this moment? Because this is the only moment anybody's home. We're not home those other moments. We are not home in the past. There's nobody there. There's nobody there in the future right now. It's clear, right? You have to do things for the well-being of your future self. She or he or they can't do it for you. They're not here to do it. They can't do it for themselves. You do this for them. Your practice is something you're doing for a future version of you in the flow of time. Neither ascent nor decline, except for the point, the still point, there would be no dance, and there is only the dance. I can only say there we have been, but I cannot say where. And I cannot say how long. For that is to place it in time. That's the access we have in that stillness is out of linear time. It's in linear time, but it's not of linear time. It's not of linear time. It's not in that flow. It's in the stillness and something, someone's delivering some package. And here's how he describes what happens in that moment. And it's a beautiful feeling of a little moment of awakening of any size. The inner freedom from the practical desire. The release from action and suffering. So we've stepped off that scale. Release from the inner and the outer compulsion. Compulsion by external events, by our own compulsions. We all know those, right? The inner freedom from the practical desire, the release from action and suffering, release from the inner and the outer compulsion, yet surrounded by a grace of sense, a white light, still and moving. A white light, still and moving. This teaching showing up over and over and over again. A white light, still and moving. Eribang, which is like exhilaration. It's like this kind of release feeling. Eribang without motion. Concentration without elimination. The one point that includes everything. Concentration without elimination, both a new world and the old made explicit, understood in the completion of its partial ecstasy, the resolution of its partial hara, meaning its partial suffering. And here's then the paradox spoken again. Yet the enchainment of past and future, being caught in chain past and future, yet the enchainment of past and future woven into the weakness of the changing body protects mankind from heaven and damnation, which flesh cannot endure. Time past and time future allow but a little consciousness. To be conscious is to not be in time. But only in time can the moment in the rose garden, the moment in the arbor where the rain beat, the moment in the drafty church at Smokefall be remembered, involved with past and future. Only through time, time is conquered. Still, and still flowing. Still water that's flowing. Flowing water that's still. In another place, which I'll read you the rest of it tomorrow, Eliot says, ridiculous the waste sad time stretching before and after. The Buddha was not in that before and after, after his and his release, his enlightenment, his nibbana, whatever you wish to call it. As I would understand it, he had moved outside that. The envelope had turned the other way. And he was, and I can now imagine that after all of these decades of practice, how that could arise for someone, which I always tend to think of it being someone else. But nonetheless, I do see it as possible in a lifetime that there be a switch in the way we're relating. Because it is in time that all of this is happening, and time is a time we do not have to be defined by time. It is to me a practical consideration, not a philosophical consideration. It's more like science. Is it possible that the mind could rearrange itself in such a way? And I would argue yes. It seems to me to be, but you have to decide for yourself. But there, in between that full enlightenment of the Buddha is all of these gradations of ever more freedom from our own greed, our own aversion, and our own delusion. And for me, the arriving at that full liberation is not necessary for motivation. I experience each moment as motivation. I experience different capacities emerging within my psyche as motivation. I don't know how you feel it, but that's how I feel it. And it motivates me, and it's motivated me for many decades. I wanted to understand this possibility, and I wanted to give myself to opening to this possibility in the manner that I felt I could. I wanted to be true to me and not to a particular form. And so I offer these teachings for you in that same manner that you would choose one to make this a larger part of your life, but in your form. I'm not advocating form. And even this knowing of stillness and movement, it is not an advocating. It's not an advocating. It's an exposing. It's an exploration so that you can include what is useful in this and discard the rest. When I talk about the importance of a felt sense, I can conceive that someone might not have any felt sense, and they'd be so in their mental capacity, so able to just 100% live there that they could do it all mentally. I can imagine that there might be somebody like that. And for periods of time in Southeast Asia, that was considered superior and meditation was looked down upon. It was the understanding that was the big thing, not the felt sense, not actually doing it. So I can conceive of that. It doesn't relate to me, and I don't think it relates to most of us. I don't think our minds are that strong, nor are in the West, are minds centered enough, long enough, so that it's a whole different culture, and I think that's very difficult. So this thing of stillness and movement in just this way. In the walking practice, I've said repeatedly, getting that felt sense. We're creating neural networks that will know the felt sense of stillness, so that in the midst of movement, we can invoke stillness. Or in the midst of stillness, we can hold that stillness and also open to movement. It's very practical. It's mysterious, but it's practical. It's mysterious, but it's not magical. It's not magical. It's lawful. It has to do with the nature of nature and the nature of our minds, this mysterious thing we call mind.